Hello, Daniel Dresner.
Hello, Rayhan Salam. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm Rayhan Salam. I'm a fellow at the New America Foundation and a blogger for National Review. And I'm here with Daniel Dresner, an old friend.
Yes, we've known each other for at least 5 years, which I think qualifies as old friend. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I also blog at foreignpolicy.com. Rayhan, I have a question for you.
Yes, please.
Which is, on your 1040, do you list like prominent young conservative as, or, you know, future of Republican Party as an occupation?
The, you know something? My father does my taxes, and I have not really seen them ever as a result. All I know is that I'm probably going to owe lots of money.
Right.
And I'm very happy to pay it because I'm a firm believer in the IRS doing good works for America and the world.
I tease you merely because, you know, in every article anywhere about the future of the Republican Party, inevitably your name gets mentioned. So I wondered if, like, you know, you get some kind of, you know, is it like a royalty or anything benefit that you get from that?
This is very disturbing because I actually am hoping to start my own Rayhanist party, which will be a kind of mixture of Christian phalangism and neoliberalism. And, you know, we're going to have kind of special helmets, stuff like that. So I think that, you know, as much as I kind of like and admire many Republican office holders, I do have my own separate plan. Dan is actually one of the reasons I got started blogging, because I was a guest blogger for DanielDresner.com many years ago with my friend Siddharth.
Yes.
And it was a tremendous treat. Mm-hmm. But we have a huge amount to talk about, and
yeah.
It helps that Professor Dresner, as I like to call you, is one of America's foremost experts on international economic policymaking, and also the strategic dimension of lots of kind of international economics issues that
sure.
we've traditionally thought of as kind of more deliberative and sort of not strategic. So this is going to be very exciting for me and hopefully for you.
Okay, fire away.
So Dan, today is the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
Yeah.
And there's, of course, been a lot of kind of comment on this. Why don't you tell me about your perspective on how this has kind of reshaped the international landscape? That's obviously a very big question, so pick whatever part of it you think is, you know, kind of chewable over.
Yeah, wow. I mean, well, first of all, I have to say, whenever we talk about this, I always think about a year ago when I did a blogging heads. It was a late-night blogging heads with Bob Wright. This was the day the stock market it wasn't Lehman. It was when Congress refused to pass the TARP provision the first time around, and the market fell something like 700, 800 points. And I basically was incredibly gloomy in that post or in that discussion, saying we're in deep trouble. And I will say that, you know, after this year, I think the pessimism was pretty much justified, given, you know, sort of the actual effects on the real economy over the year. But that said, I'm probably much more optimistic now than I was a year ago. In terms of where I see the future of the global economy...
Much more optimistic in what sense? Much more optimistic that we're going to avoid kind of total Mad Max-style doom? Or
yes,
optimistic?
I think we've avoided, you know, the hoarding of gold, I think I had a post last year around this time saying I'm going long on duct tape and shotguns, you know, the Cormac McCarthy the road kind of scenarios. These sorts of things I am less concerned now about them actually happening. This does not mean we're out of the woods. And, you know, it's interesting as we speak today that I think Ben Bernanke said today we're probably out of the recession, although he's talking about economic growth there as opposed to employment. But still, that's always an encouraging thing to hear. You know, I think hopefully a lot of the damage has been done. And therefore, I am knocking on wood when I'm saying this, but I really do hope that the worst is over. And in a lot of ways, I've been pleasantly surprised with how things have gone over the past year. You know, if you think about it, the sort of architecture for, you know, the global political, the global economy, the institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the IMF, even the G20, you know, these are sort of the times that try those, and this has been a giant stress test of those institutions. And I have to say that if you had asked me a year ago how they would do to date, I'd have been pleasantly surprised, which is to say, they haven't done spectacularly well, but on the other hand, the system has by and large held up. You haven't seen wave after wave of protectionism. You've seen some ticky-tack stuff, and the stuff I'm concerned about down the road, but, you know, you haven't seen massive increases.
Can
in
you tell us some? Yeah, tell us, play out some of the disaster scenarios that you imagined at the time and still think are fairly plausible. Or
would
have been plausible.
The disaster scenarios were that, you know, with you know, all the major economies contracting, there could have been a whole bunch of things that could have happened. There could have been a run on the dollar. That was certainly a plausible scenario, because had the Chinese panicked, or had other, you know, sovereign holders of U.S. dollar debt panicked, they would have dumped their dollars, and there would have been a crashing down of the value of the dollar. That was one possibility. Another possibility was that the financial system, the world financial system, post Lehman, was simply going to seize up and go into the Mad Max level, where no one was going to borrow or lend to anyone else. And we nearly hit that, but we didn't quite hit that. And I think it's to, you know, a whole bunch of central bankers' credits that, in fact, they did intervene, and they intervened massively, but the intervention, by and large, worked. And even, you know, as we talk about this month, you know, a whole variety of facilities that the Fed created are slowly being phased out because, you know, the commercial paper market is now functioning relatively normally, these kinds of things. So the financial system simply having a massive heart attack did not happen either. They, you know, there were some palpitations, but they didn't have a heart attack. The third thing, and this is the sort of natural concern of free traders, was that when you had, you know, this kind of recession, you were going to see really, really stupid trade policies being implemented and massive increases in protection. Now, you haven't seen that. You've seen, you know, symbolically stupid things. You've seen the Buy America provisions in the U.S. stimulus bill back in January. There is a Buy China provision in the Chinese stimulus bill. There's been a whole lot of other things done by Russia, by India, what have you, that have not been great. But by and large, these have been limited measures that haven't affected the total flow of global trade. So again, the important thing is the dog that didn't bark, which is you did not see a real genuine collapse of the world trading system.
What do you think would have been the driver of that? I mean, because it seems that in the United States, I'm actually a little surprised by the extent to which you haven't seen a real upsurge in economic nationalism. Is it because you've just seen a kind of this is despite the fact that free trade remains actually quite unpopular and has arguably become more unpopular over the last 10 years as kind of upper middle class Americans have soured on trade. Is it because people see that as less salient, or is it because the elite consensus proved relatively robust? What do you think was the reason? I mean, sort of first on the domestic side and then maybe more broadly.
I would say on the domestic side, there is a tremendous antipathy towards free trade. I think the reason is the tyranny of the status quo, which is you have the U.S. embedded in a whole series of trade agreements with the WTO, with NAFTA, with a whole variety of other bilateral trading agreements. And it's not easy to change those rules. So, you know, the biggest thing was that, and this is a sharp distinction of what happened during, let's say, the Great Depression years, is that there was already an institutional infrastructure in place that stacked the deck in favor of having an open economy. That was at least on the trade side. On the financial side, you had, you know, interest groups with a very strong stake in keeping capital markets open, you know, including even the battered financial sector. So I think it's not that public sentiment changed or that public sentiment became any more supportive of trade. It was simply that public sentiment was not translated into policy change, in large part because even protectionists are not saying, let's pull out of the WTO. I mean, you're not seeing anything, you know, galactically stupid on that level. And below that, you know, really all you can do is see increases in anti-dumping measures, which you have, and safeguard measures, which we'll talk about as well. You know, and in most cases, that doesn't affect a broad swath of the economy.
So one of the things that you've studied, I mean, you've done a tremendous amount of work on international institutions and just the idea of, you know, enforcing kind of cooperation when it comes to international agreements.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned in passing in a recent blog post that the G20 is just a very kind of unwieldy organization. And one of the big priorities a lot of folks have been talking about is this idea of rebalancing the global economy.
Yeah.
And some have optimistically suggested that perhaps the G20 can be some instrument whereby we can affect this kind of rebalancing. And tell me what you think about this. Tell me what you think first about the evolution from the kind of G8 to the G20, and then about the efficacy of this institution in terms of achieving some of these big-ticket changes.
Well, I would say first, I mean, it's not that there hasn't been an evolution from the G8 to the G20. The G8 is still around. It's just that the G20 became the much more important body over the past year. And in some ways, it's sort of surprising in how quickly that transition took place. It took place back in November when, you know, in addition to the G8 meeting, there was a G20 meeting, sort of an emergency summit convened. The G20 had been in existence, by the way, for 10 years before that. It had just been a meeting of the finance ministers and had been a largely, you know, sort of nothing body, which was a one-year, you know, it would be an annual summit, which, you know, you have a communique that was issued and nothing else. The reason you saw this shift to the G20 was simply put, the G8 wasn't big enough anymore. If you were going to address both the sort of global economic crisis and the sort of underlying macroeconomic imbalances, you had to include countries that were not in the G8, most importantly China, but also certainly India, Brazil, Saudi Arabia to a lesser extent. So, I mean, this was just a matter of pure and straight realpolitik. Now, in some ways, the problem, you know, and Bob Zelick, who's the president of the World Bank, said this, is the G20 is in some sense an accident of history. If you could start with a clean slate and draw up which countries you'd want to, you know, have to want to come attend these kinds of things, you'd probably come up with fewer than 20 countries. And, you know, generally fewer is better when it comes to these kinds of things, because the fewer number of people in the room, the more likely you might actually reach an agreement.
Facilitates policy coordination.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, that said, I think the G20 deserves relatively high marks on policy coordination, particularly on things like fiscal policy. You know, I mean, the G20, I don't think, will quite reach what the IMF's target of fiscal stimulus of about 2% of global economic output, but they're going to come close. And, you know, that's actually kind of pleasantly surprising, because macroeconomic policy coordination is not something that you know, the G7 or the G20 have a great history with. Now, that said, this has been the easy part. The easy part is economies in crisis, therefore you must do everything possible to try to stimulate your own economy. All politicians have a incentive to do that. The tricky part is going to come when people like Bernanke and others start saying, okay, we now see, you know, not just green shoots, but let's say green stems. I'm going to trademark that, by the way, in case we, you know, start seeing that more importantly. Green stems, remember, you heard it here first. Green stems in terms of economic growth. Then you're going to start seeing central bankers and other, you know, most likely the Germans starting to say, okay, now it's time to clamp down on this sort of quantitative easing on the monetary side and fiscal stimulus on the government expenditure side. And some governments are going to agree with that and some aren't. So I think that the tough stuff is still to come, to be sure. But that said, there's at least an initially promising track record.
This seems like a really deep structural issue that's going to be persistent, namely the fact that in the United States, I mean, there's this broad view that in Europe, and particularly the Germans, aren't doing enough in terms of fiscal stimulus, whereas actually, you know, kind of we're doing a fair bit, yet it's going to be leaky, and it's not necessarily going to be as effective as it might be were we to coordinate, yet the Germans have their own anxieties about the kind of massive debt levels they're already carrying. I wonder, what's your perspective on this? Because, you know, what I hear from Germans is that, you know, actually, in terms of our so-called automatic stabilizers, we're already doing a fair bit, and, you know, kind of for us to do much more would be tremendously risky. Do you think that's a fair objection on their part, or do you think that actually they should do more of the heavy lifting?
I think it's pretty much horseshit, but, you know, let me put it this way. The automatic stabilizer argument, I think, has just enough of a patina of plausibility so that you can't laugh at them in their face when they say it. I mean, it's true. The automatic stabilizers will increase, you know, during a downturn. That said, this is the kind of downturn where you can't just rely on automatic stabilizers. You also want at least, you know, a couple of one-shot fiscal boosts in addition to that. And it's not like the Germans really the Germans, unfortunately, have a track record, have an economic history where they've been burned badly by inflation, both in the 1920s during hyperinflation and the 1990s during reunification. So this partially colors why the Germans have been so loath to take action. But, you know, by and large, I would label them the biggest free riders of the global economy over the past year because they haven't done all that much, whereas the Japanese, who have much higher debt-to-GDP ratios, have engaged in you know, significant fiscal stimulus. The Chinese certainly have. The United States has, even, you know, other BRIC economies like India and Brazil have. So, no, I'd blame the Germans a fair amount.
That's interesting. So, I mean, and you find that there are concerns about their debt levels to just not be because, like, sort of the Japanese are kind of far more indebted. So, basically, mm-hmm. the Germans are trying to free ride on the efforts made by these other countries. That's a...
I would say, to be fair, they are free riding. But I also do think they come at this from not a cynical but rather a genuine conviction that they don't engage in what I think Per Steinbrück called crass Keynesianism. You know, they've always been much more obsessed with anti-inflation policies than most of the rest of Europe, not to mention the rest of the global economy. So I don't mean to say that they're being cynical about this. I think they're being articulating genuine policy preferences. It's just in the process of doing that, I think they're free riding off of everyone else.
Well, with speaking of inflation, I mean, this has become a big, big topic. I mean, Ken Rogoff, and he's not the only one, but sort of he's one of many economists who've been saying that, you know, basically, given the kind of long-term government debt crisis we're likely to see coming out of the financial crisis, yep. you know, there's a very limited menu of options. We can see incredibly sharp spending cuts, we can see tax increases, and we can see some effort to gin up moderate sustained inflation. And this isn't just Rogoff. I mean, Greg Mankiw has also made similar noises in this direction. My New America colleague Chris Hayes has just published a paper arguing that, you know, the Federal Reserve should set a target in the neighborhood of 3 to 5% inflation per annum for the next couple of years at least.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? I mean, does this strike you as dangerously crazy? Does it strike you as a pretty reasonable? Or does it strike you something that would be impossible to implement?
Well, I mean, you know, Paul Volcker tried to target monetary growth. So let me step back for a second and answer that question again. I don't think it's unreasonable for people like Rogoff and so forth to be concerned about the specter of long-term inflation. That said, let's face it, what the Fed has done to date has in no way whatsoever led to inflation.
Rogoff is actually saying we should have inflation.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry.
That actually would be a good thing, and that, you know, yeah, I'm certainly like, deflation is the problem now.
I'm sorry. Wow, Rogoff said that? That's interesting. I have to admit, I this is the kind of moment where you wind up not necessarily, you know, there's a valid point to be made there, which is it's certainly one way to ease the kind of debt burden that we're looking at going forward. And, you know, the real concern about that is how would foreign creditors respond, i.e. China, but it's not clear that they would have any choice or any, you know, possible way to alter to U.S. policies on this, because there's nowhere else they can buy, you know, enough debt securities or enough foreign exchange as opposed to the dollar. So they can't substitute away from the dollar. So that's not a bad point. I would argue, however, that I think a lot of the concern about the sort of long-term debt burden, I get very, not cynical, but I get very, it carries an air of unreality. It's worth remembering that 10 years ago at this time, there were debates about the massive government surplus that we were going to experience year on year going forward. So I always get very wary about long-term debt projections or long-term surplus projections.
That's interesting. I mean, the one thing, I think one reason why people are a bit more worried now is because you also have a kind of demographic issue coming to a head at the same time.
Right.
I mean, I think that it's true that when you look at the United States, you know, kind of position in 1991, you know, the debt was heavier, was quite heavy at the time, and, you know,
right.
we managed to work it out. If you look at Canada, you know, similarly, they kind of went through this kind of wrenching period, and then through the 90s, they managed to kind of sharply decrease the size of their debt relative to GDP. But, I mean, I think that part of the concern that people have, and it could be misplaced, but is that, you know, our political culture seems to be paralyzed.
Right.
And also that, you know, again, you have this kind of rapid aging of the population. And, you know, whereas you had in the 90s, you had, you know, kind of the kind of service sector productivity boom. You just wonder how much more can you wring out of that? I mean, sort of, do we have a lot of low-hanging fruit in the U.S. economy to kind of enhance our long-run growth prospects? And I think that that's kind of why people are maybe more worried than they might have been in the past.
No, I agree. I mean, I think this fundamentally, the answer to some extent largely revolves around how quickly the economy is actually going to recover, which is the quicker the economy gets into positive rates of growth and relatively higher rates of growth, suddenly a lot of these debt projections look better. Because among other things, it means we're bringing in more tax revenues and presumably our own automatic stabilizers start to go down. So I think that's one issue. In terms of the inflation, I think moderate levels of inflation aren't necessarily a bad thing. I would say 3 to 4% is what I'm comfortable with. I wouldn't be comfortable with 5%.
Yeah.
And God knows we've had years of 4% inflation for the past couple, you know, decades. So it's hardly unprecedented to do that. I think it does make some sense to have, you know, sort of, let's say, shift up the inflation target a little bit. And in that sense, Bernanke is well suited for this because he's actually implicitly, I think, made this argument in some of his other academic work before going to the Fed. So I don't think it's unreasonable. I think in terms of getting a grip on the sort of longer-term, you know, demographic and entitlement problems, yeah, that's an issue, and it's an issue where I don't know how well our political system is capable of dealing with this. In that, by and large, these kinds of things require usually two-thirds buy-in. They require the kind of, you know, veto-proof buy-ins such that you at least get some kind of bipartisan support. And I have to admit, I'm not sure we've got the political culture right now for that to happen.
Well, tell me about, you've mentioned Bernanke a couple of times. Tell me your perception of his performance, and if you think the president was right to reappoint him.
I think the president was right to reappoint him, if for no other reason that, you know, this, even though we're coming out, you know, we're emerging from the depths of the recession, you know, there's still a fair amount of uncertainty going on. And let's face it, I think Bernanke's replacement, if there had been one, would have been Larry Summers, who is a brilliant guy by any, you know, definition of the word brilliant, but I'm not necessarily sure possessor of the greatest amount of political acumen. And I think one of the interesting ways in which Bernanke has been very different...
Sorry about that. Please continue.
That's okay. That was a slow motion laugh. I like that. I think one of the ways in which Bernanke has been different, not just from Summers, obviously, but also from his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, has been the extent to which he's actually tried to engage in public outreach, you know, willing to go on Sunday morning talk shows, willing to hold town hall meetings, trying more quickly to make the minutes of the Federal Open Markets Committee meetings transparent. And so in that sense, given this current crisis, it's oddly enough, you know, his political skills are going to be useful. Of course, not that it necessarily has done him any good. In fact, I think the Gallup had a poll over the summer that showed the Fed was less popular, in fact, than the IRS as a institution, which is just a bad, bad sign.
I mean, it's a bad sign, yet, I mean, in your experience, I sort of have never really heard much about federal approval ratings prior to this kind of latest round of concern. I mean, you wonder what it was during the Volcker era. And you also wonder, you know, given that there seems to be a strong elite consensus around central bank independence, although on the other hand, you have seen moves, the Ron Paul legislation in the House that suggests that there's perhaps more popular support for curbing the Fed than there has been in a really long time.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which, you know, that public distaste for the Fed actually takes some kind of actionable form. Is that fair to say, or do you think that...
I think that's likely true. I also think, to be fair, that public the poll results showing public distaste for the Fed has less to do with the Fed itself than it's just sort of this inchoate anger targeted at someone they think is responsible for the current... simultaneously for the current downturn and for the fact that the Fed seemed willing to intervene, you know, to help banks. That, you know, the word bailout got associated with the Fed in ways that were unfortunate. But, I mean, I think that's the other, you know, to go back to our first point, you know, if there's any lesson that I think we draw from the last year's worth of events, it is in part the fact that that a lot of these bailouts, which were incredibly politically unpopular when they were first imposed, worked out pretty damn well. And then in some cases, the Fed is actually going to be making a profit on these things.
Yeah. That is really interesting.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was talking to the political economist Mark Blythe, who was at Johns Hopkins and is now going to be at Brown, and it was interesting because he was just sort of saying in passing that there's something about, you know, any kind of major undertaking by the government where when you try to cost it out beforehand, you're going to yield one set of conclusions, yet there's a way in which, you know, these kind of big-ticket reforms or big-ticket bailouts, big, you know, these big efforts actually have a kind of gravity-defying effect. That actually, you know, kind of means that they kind of defy that kind of measurement. So, I mean, you know, certainly when you're looking at something like TARP, like, yeah, I mean, the current numbers make it look as though actually the government might end up making a little bit of money off of this, although it's kind of very hard to say, you know, projecting much further out.
Right.
But, you know, in a similar vein, I mean, you know, when you're costing out, you know, for example, the Clean Air Act and sort of, you know, kind of a lot of the measures that were taken to kind of combat acid rain, et cetera, there was kind of one set of guesses regarding the regulatory impact, the kind of costs that it would impose on the broader economy. And it turns out that those were massive overestimates. Now, I think that some people glibly conclude, ergo, we could do anything we want and it's going to cost, you know, kind of not that much, so we shouldn't worry about it. But I am fascinated by that and the way that it is so kind of weirdly probabilistic. And, you know, our whole politics kind of surrounds these estimates that might not actually bear any resemblance to reality.
Well, I mean, this gets back to the other point you were talking about, which is it's true. Our political system, and frankly, I'm not sure any political system, is terribly well geared towards policies where you're talking about a decade or two down the road. We just suck at that. And part of the – I mean, there's two reasons for that. The first is that no politician has ever – you know, gotten any benefit from doing something that involves short-term cost at the with the reward of long-term gain, because you know in the long term all politicians are dead. And the second problem is that to do these kind of long-range policy analysis, you know, it helps to have some better data about what we can expect in the future. And as you just pointed out, and as I said before, our long-term data projections are usually off by orders of magnitude.
Yeah. This is, so tell me about this idea of rebalancing the global economy that has come up so often. One, I was reading Rogoff had a column at Project Syndicate that I very much enjoyed, in which he was talking specifically about rebalancing the U.S.-China relationship.
Yeah.
And his basic argument was that, as we all know, you know, consumption has been about 70% of U.S. GDP.
Right.
You know, we can easily imagine that going down to about 60%, and you know, you're going to have sluggish consumer demand for a long period of time. You're going to have higher rates of savings, but those savings are leakier than they would have been in past eras. So, you know, we could be looking at a fairly long period of kind of persistent, stubborn, high unemployment.
Yeah.
And also low growth. And similarly, China, given China's scale, this kind of export orientation means that actually they might have to kind of sort of curb their growth as well. I mean, they're presumably going to shift toward sort of a more kind of domestic consumer demand oriented economy, but
right.
It's hard to see them sustaining sort of these kind of rates of growth when you have sort of throughout, you know, kind of the global economy, this kind of suppressed consumer demand. Does that sound plausible to you? And if that does happen, I mean, where does the growth come from? And, you know, kind of what does that do to these countries as strategic actors?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I agree with Rogoff. The long-term picture in terms of rebalancing the global economy looks like this. Bluntly put, the United States needs to consume less, and China needs to consume more. And by that, we mean personal consumption rates. Now, you can argue that the U.S. has actually gone further along this road than the Chinese have, in large part because you know, savings rates between the United States were negative, you know, for a couple months, at least a few years ago. I think the last data point on savings rates is that we're now over 5% U.S. savings, which is not great, but is light years better than we were talking about 1 year, 2 year, or 3 years ago. Of course, the problem is that if you're interested in trying to, you know, reboot the U.S. economy, high savings rates mean that the economy is going to be slow growing. But on the other hand, for this kind of rebalancing to take place, you've got the U.S. needs to consume less and save more. So that's been reasonably you've seen the right steps in that direction. On China's side, you know, this is a much thornier problem for the Chinese. The Chinese have known for years now, and they've publicly acknowledged that their economy is unbalanced and they need to engage more in boosting domestic consumption and being less oriented towards exports. And yet, the problem that the Chinese have is that a lot of their savings comes in the form of corporate savings from their state-run corporations. And while that's a problem, it's also somewhat useful for the Chinese because it gives them a policy lever that the U.S. doesn't have. I mean, China's basically engineered its own credit bubble over the past 6 months as a way to boost domestic spending in China, investment spending. It doesn't really know how to boost consumption. The only way it can do that, paradoxically, is by reforming its own financial sector. The only way it can do that is for Chinese consumers to feel like they don't need to hoard large amounts of cash.
Right, and so that could be the advent of a kind of more a robust Chinese welfare state, right? I mean, if
right.
they had, you know, kind of stronger public pensions, public health care.
It's two things. They need a robust welfare state, you know, including healthcare and things like that. They also need a robust domestic financial system. Part of the problem in China is that if you're going to take a mortgage, there is no such thing as taking a mortgage out in China. You need to have a large amount of cash in order to be able to buy property. If there's a healthcare problem, you have to have large amounts of cash on hand. So as a result, there is no consumer credit sector in China, or what it is incredibly primitive. And so as a result, Chinese consumers don't feel like unlike American consumers, for temporary periods they can live on debt or credit. So oddly enough, what you would have to have the Chinese do is to both expand their welfare state, expand the provision of public goods, but also reform and liberalize their finance sector. But of course, that's the exact opposite lesson that they've taken the exact opposite lesson from the current crisis. Their lesson from the current crisis is the last thing they want to do is liberalize that sector.
So we could actually swap central bank officials, basically. I mean, we could just have some sort of trade.
It would be
like
nice,
a 10-year period.
But it's not just that; it's also regulatory officials.
Right.
You know, and you know, a piece worth reading. Noam Schieber's got a piece in today, I think, in the New Republic today, on the sort of Sino-American relationship, you know, with regard to rebalancing. And, you know, most of the Chinese officials involved recognize that they've got to also do some stuff on this. But in some ways, what this harkens back to is the Structural Impediments Initiative that the U.S. and Japan launched back in the late 80s when it seemed like that was the macroeconomic imbalance. And it took the Japanese still haven't engaged in some of those structural reforms. So it's not going to be easy for China to do this. They have to do it, though. I just don't know how it's going
to
happen.
This is not your wheelhouse, and it's kind of an unfair question because I certainly don't have an answer to it myself. But, I mean, do you see any way that the United States can achieve unemployment that is both a high savings economy and also a high employment economy? Because, I mean, my sense is that persistent unemployment rates above 8% are a social disaster in the United States for a lot of complicated reasons that you understand and I think many in our audience understand.
Right. Can you repeat the question? Was your question, can the U.S. have high growth rates but also high unemployment rates?
Oh, no. Can we have high savings and also high employment?
Oh, high savings and high employment. Yeah, I think we can, actually, because if you balance that with high investment rates, then you're also, you know, boosting then you're still boosting the domestic economy. So,
but given that,
possible.
Like, sort of, you know, one thing that, I mean, Zachary Carabel has written about this, and I think that a lot of his stuff has been really, really thought-provoking, but just when you're looking at the kind of investment opportunities globally that, you know, U.S.-based multinationals have, you know, clearly the growth is not happening in the domestic U.S. economy, right? I mean, it's happening, you know, it's arguably happening in India, it's happening in Brazil, it's happening in all a slew of places, such that, you know, kind of over a 10-year period, you had at a time when U.S.-based multinationals were making, you know, a fifth of their profits, you know, outside of the U.S., and now it's, you know, oftentimes over half. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of, I guess, the question, because, I mean, of course, those savings, you know, by domestic savers are going to be leakier, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. There's no question that U.S. saving. I mean, one of the odd aspects of the sort of flow of capital flows of the last 10 years is that it's in the developing countries that have by and large been risk averse and buying up, you know, U.S. debt, and it's been U.S. investors who have been willing to take the risk in developing countries. So the U.S. oddly enough has a comparative advantage in risk, which is actually one of the reasons why it's been able to run the massive current account deficits it has, and yet still maintain a relatively stable net international interest payment position, because U.S. investments abroad produce much more higher rates of return than foreign investments in the United States.
Yeah. So you wonder, and if there's a perception of the kind of risk of investing in the American economy having changed, and that would not be unreasonable, you know, you kind of wonder what's going to happen to that, what has been a relatively happy arrangement for us.
No, I mean, that's worth it's worth mulling over. I mean, I think, let me put it this way. I'm not entirely convinced that the sole aspect of U.S. growth in terms of investment is going to be overseas. I think there's a fair amount of infrastructure investment that can go on in this country that'll yield a relatively high rate of return. And, you know, part of the problem, I mean, this is what you're asking in some ways is a question that I always hate being asked, which is, where's going to be the next engine of growth in the United States? If it's not going to be, you know, IT services, what else is it going to be? And the answer I always give is the same, which is, if I knew that, I wouldn't be speaking here. I'd be on my yacht
somewhere.
You
wouldn't be talking to me,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. The point is that very often it's someplace you don't anticipate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my kind of it's sort of certainly kind of a lot of people I talk to, and I am a congenital optimist, but I mean, certainly kind of very smart, sober people seem to think that, you know, we're in for a period that will be, you know, somewhat meaner, somewhat cleaner version of the 1970s, but with high-speed internet, which will make it, you know, kind of a lot more bearable. And hopefully we won't be wearing, you know, preposterous pants. But
will Starsky and Hutch come back? Because it's not fun unless Starsky and Hutch come back.
I think that, well, and it's also like one, I mean, that's what's actually so tragic about the kind of trade picture that you're describing, and yes, we managed to get out of this year without major trade conflict, but as you suggest in an essay that's going to be published shortly, we actually, you know, could very well see a lot more of it in the years to come, because, I mean, you know, Americans are clearly going to be beneficiaries from growth happening in the developing world.
Yes.
You know, if actually growth opportunities at home are actually, you know, kind of fairly restrained.
Yeah.
Yet, I mean, that's exactly, you know, kind of, you know, we're in danger of kind of sabotaging that. But tell me about, you know, kind of why you think that the kind of success we've had in avoiding a trade war might come undone in the near-term future.
Well, let me preface this by saying that, you know, I'm going to make an argument against the argument I'm about to make, which is it has to be acknowledged that free traders are just a jittery lot. You know, any mild, you know, mildly protectionist action automatically triggers this cascade of rhetoric of, oh my God, you know, it's Smoot-Hawley 2 or, you know, new waves of protectionism and oh dear God, you know, the end is nigh. And I've tried to resist using that kind of language, particularly with regard to the Obama administration, because frankly, for the first 8 months or so, there hasn't been much action on trade on the Obama from the Obama administration. But the latest thing is very disturbing, which is that the administration announced a safeguard action in which it applied a 35% tariff on imported Chinese tires, taking advantage of a sort of special part of the agreement of China's accession to the WTO. And this bothers me for a couple of reasons. The first is that because of the way China acceded to the WTO, the U.S., by taking this action, gives every other country that's a WTO signatory carte blanche to launch an exact same identical action without engaging in any investigation of their own. In other words, by pointing to the U.S., investigation, they can say, you know what, we're going to apply a 35% tariff as well. So the U.S., by doing this, isn't just, you know, doing it for itself, it's also giving everyone else an excuse to do it. The second problem is that, you know, all administrations engage in various forms of protection. You know, the Bush administration, you know, did the steel tariffs in 2002 that no trade economist was enthusiastic about. The Clinton administration, before that, you know, talked a lot about attaching labor and environmental standards to trade deals, even though those provisions were often considered toxic by developing country members. And yet, in both of these administrations, those steps towards protectionism were counterbalanced by real genuine effort, you know, serious amounts of political capital being devoted to trade liberalizing measures. So in the case of the Clinton administration, you know, Clinton, you can argue, lost health care in part because he was willing and he prioritized the passage of both NAFTA and the Uruguay round of the WTO. The Bush administration was able to get Trade Promotion Authority passed in 2002, was able to jumpstart the Doha round and sign and ratify major, you know, trade agreements with Australia, Singapore, and Central American countries. The problem with when you look at Obama is twofold. First, there is no other trade record to speak of when it comes to the Obama administration. This is the very first and loudest action they've taken on trade, which sets a pretty bad precedent, if you ask me. The second concern, and this is really what bothers me, is the politics of this, which is it's very clear that if you look at Obama's sort of political base, they see this as just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, Thea Lee, who's the chief economist of the AFL-CIO, you know, was quoted in the New York Times today talking about how this was just a down payment as far as they were concerned on trade enforcement actions. And they expect to see a lot more of this coming from the Obama administration from here on in. And there's part of me that wonders if one of the things that the administration is doing is basically viewing trade as a sacrificial lamb to keep its domestic coalition strong enough to pass major health care or financial regulation or global warming initiatives. And if that's the case, then, oh dear God, you know, what starts as mild queasiness turns into major nausea when it comes to trade policy, because it seems clear Obama is willing to, you know, sacrifice trade policy in favor of other policy priorities. Now, you know, if you care about those policy priorities, then good on you. If you care about trade, this is a disaster if this is actually what happens.
A couple of things come to mind. I mean, one is that, you know, it's true that when you saw previous administrations, there were both protectionist measures that were balanced by, you know, market opening measures, by liberalizing measures. But one wonders how much low-hanging fruit there is right now. For example, at the Kennedy School, Land Pritchett has talked a lot about how when you're looking at further liberalization of trading goods and services, you know, you get relatively little bang for the buck from the perspective of the developing world, whereas doing things with regard to labor mobility, which is, of course, even more politically toxic, but would actually kind of yield, you know, kind of far bigger gains. And I wonder, in terms of kind of the liberalizing agenda, I mean, it seems like, you know, one thing is that, you know, there, and Jagdish Bhagwati has written a lot about this, there's a lot of concern about departures from the kind of multilateral, you know, kind of from the WTA, yeah. from kind of multilateral liberalization in favor of kind of lots of bilateral deals, et cetera, or regional, you know, preferential trade agreements or, you know, regional free trade areas. And I just sort of wonder, you know, kind of even if the Obama White House, even if they were committed free traders, I wonder, you know, how much they could do. I mean, and you know, to be sure, doing no harm is kind of quite a lot in
itself.
Well,
I was going to say, I mean, I generally tend to agree with that. A lot of the low-hanging fruit's already been picked. You know, the sort of major trade policy initiatives or major trade liberalizing steps, a lot of them have to be taken by the developing world, not the developed world. The developed world, with the very important exception of agriculture, is by and large, you know, sort of barrier-free. I mean, it's not perfect, but they're pretty good. So I think agricultural subsidies for in the developed world are the sort of big liberalizing step that can be taken. But I think the real problem is not so much that the Obama administration is failing to take further liberalizing steps. It's that they're taking a massive step backwards. So long as if the administration was holding the status quo, if they weren't, you know, engaging in relatively egregious forms of protectionism, I wouldn't be that disturbed, and I haven't been that disturbed, you know, to date about what the administration has done. You know, going to the WTO and taking trade cases to the WTO is absolutely appropriate.
I have another question for you,
okay.
Paul Krugman has written a bit about this, but, you know, one issue that's coming up when we're talking about major measures designed to curb climate change is the idea of factoring this into trade.
Yeah.
You know, and you have, you know, Stiglitz has talked about this idea as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The idea that, you know, kind of do we sort of correct? Because, you know, a lot of, you know, folks in the developing world will say, I think rightly, that when we're talking about carbon emissions sharply spiking in China, a lot of that is actually in goods producing industries that are producing goods that are consumed in the developed world. And so there's a certain irony and sort of, you know, you're naturally going to have this kind of shift across jurisdictions. And
actually,
so you have folks
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, this is actually, I think, one of the bigger fictions when it comes, or one of the bigger mirages when it comes to the intersection of trade and the environment. The notion that if you apply green sanctions to, you know, to products that are made with heavy amounts of CO, you know, carbon dioxide, that you can somehow alter environmental policies in the developing world. I think the dirty secret about, you know, carbon emissions in the developing world is that most of those emissions are for domestic purposes, which is to say energy.
Oh, look. I think that's probably right, but I think that there's also some non-trivial amount that's, you know, I mean, I think when you're talking about a country that, you know, kind of where the growth is export-oriented, I think that it's not totally unreasonable of the folks in China and India to say on normative grounds, and there are lots of other ways of putting it rather than that sort of narrow technical point, but that, you know,
yeah.
Hey, you guys became rich, you know, kind of while growing dirty, and sort of now you're kind of, so I mean, I think that, you know, I don't want to confuse the issue. But
well,
let me put it this way.
My point is the following. I agree that, you know, China and India are incredibly paranoid about the notion that you're going to see these green sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
My point is that Krugman seems to think that these sanctions will actually work in altering behavior. I would actually posit that they won't, in large part because green sanctions, you know, there's a book that just came out from the Brookings Institution that Lael Brainard edited, that points out that, in fact, you know, most of the forms of CO2 emission come from products targeted at domestic markets. The sort of globalization aspect of this has a very, you know, it's a minor player in the growth of global warming.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure it's housing, it's the transportation
yeah.
sector.
It's housing, transportation, cement,
yeah.
the, you know, utilities, these kinds of things. Now, to some extent, they do bleed over into the global economy, but it's a very sanctions aren't going to, you know, the sort of green tariffs are not going to work on this.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, but I mean, it is interesting because I think that it's something that's going to, I think we're going to hear a lot more about it.
Yeah.
And I think that it also does have a surface plausibility greater than other protectionist measures that we're likely to see. So I kind of have, you know, and, you know, Sarkozy was talking about this kind of years ago. And so, you know, kind of, I wonder if we're going to hear more about it in the future.
Well, if I was, you know, to counter Sarkozy, I think we should have an anti-happiness tariff. I think we
so that happy countries are punished
exactly.
economically?
Well, no. I think unhappy countries should be punished economically. That would be something Sarkozy would presumably approve of. You know,
yeah.
which is, you know, that wouldn't, could you imagine the board that would determine the unhappiness tariff? You know, we've determined that, you know, Vietnam is a terrifically happy country, but Bangladesh is a very unhappy country. Therefore, we're going to apply a happiness tariff against Bangladesh. That would be funny. I'm sorry, that was just a bad joke. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that would be very cruel. I wonder if there is some other way of applying the tariff so that, you know, for example, or you could actually have kind of, you could swap people. You could also sort of, you know, kind of have the export of various, you know, drugs that are designed to delight people, something like that. I wonder, are there any other kind of aspects? Okay, so basically, you know, my sense is that, you know, kind of you think that, you know, kind of in America, we're going to have to tighten our belts. The Germans are bastards who are trying to free ride, and, you know, they're going to have to, but that it's not going to work, right? I mean, because it's sort of, I mean, sort of, let's say, you know, they're continue to kind of, like, rely on this export-led recovery, but it just doesn't actually happen. I mean, and I guess the Germans are just going to be left holding the bag, and they're going to be left stagnant, or what happens then? Are they then going to have to embrace fiscal stimulus when it's too late?
You know, the Germans have been recovering more quickly, actually, you can argue, than the United States, certainly, and in large part that has to do with the free riding. On the other hand, you know, the rate of German economic growth suggests, yes, they're going to be stagnant. They're large players now, but, you know, as time goes forward, they're going to be less and less relevant in this sense. So, yeah, I guess that would be my answer. It doesn't mean you can. They're too big to ignore right now. And the European Union writ large is a global act. You know, is a global actor, is a significant player in the global economy. But you know, if the EU continues to be paralyzed by indecision on these kinds of things, then yeah, you know, suddenly the G2 of the United States and China seems much more important than something like a G20 or any other kind of global economic body.
So if growth slows in both China and the United States, I mean, is it possible for India, Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, for these other societies to pick up the slack to some degree, or do you think it just means that global growth is going
possible,
to be slower than it has been?
I would say India and Brazil, absolutely. Although, you know, India is going to be the most interesting country because in terms of, you know, it's the largest in terms of population and has the potential to grow at an astronomical rate. Brazil, you know, yeah, it'll be an important player, but, you know,
Its scale is not such that it can really...
Yeah, you're not talking about a trillion people. You're talking about a couple hundred million people. Russia, no. Russia's a disaster. Russia is just a demographic disaster that, you know, it's a dead country and they don't know it yet, I guess, to be blunt about it.
To some degree, I sometimes wonder if, I mean, you know, given sort of the kind of anxiety that a lot of us have about rebalancing, about the idea that the kind of core economies are not going to be able to have the same growth they've had in the past, if this actually seems like a fairly good moment to think about, you know, kind of development assistance as not so much a kind of side dish on the kind of menu of global growth, but as something that we actually, you know, really need to think seriously about as a way of kind of ginning up, you know, more consumption in the developing world. I mean, of course, we don't have any silver bullets, but it's an interesting way to think about it because, I mean, if you were able to, like, slightly marginally increase the growth rate in sub-Saharan Africa from, you know, kind of, you know, 1.5-2% to, you know, you know, from 2 to 2.5, that could make, you know, a considerable difference. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it makes a considerable difference for Africans. It doesn't make a considerable difference for the United States.
Right, because they're such a tiny slice of the global economy now, yeah.
Right. I would actually argue that the problem here is that, by and large, the Chinese might be pursuing the strategy much more likely. They're much more likely to pursue the strategy than the Americans. For the Obama administration, this is one of those dead, you know, development aid is always a dead bang loser, particularly if you have unemployment rates close to double.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine it sort of being, I mean,
for the Chinese, though, but this is important for the Chinese, this is a great strategy because the Chinese problem has always been they're drowning in dollars and they don't know what to do with it. If they can spend the dollars externally, well, that at least, you know, is one kind of, you know, small safety valve they can use as a way to you know, partially correct their macro imbalances. So they can dole out aid like it's candy to both sub-Saharan Africa, Central Asia, even Latin America potentially.
So what last question for you, and this relates more to domestic politics. So you had been, if I recall correctly, a young Reaganite, and, you know, I think that you've drifted to the center over time. You know,
I would like to think the party has drifted further to the right, but I take your point, yes.
Yeah, no, that. So, I mean, when you're observing the domestic political scene right now, and, you know, you are someone who kind of I think of as belonging to the kind of budget balancing sensible center. I think that, you know, you've rightly said that, you know, the fantasy that we can, you know, kind of tax cut our way into kind of revenue increases is current. So, I mean, what do you think about the kind of general health of the kind of domestic political conversation when you're looking at the health reform debate? And that's clearly not, you know, kind of a core issue for you. Yeah. But what does it signal to you?
Again, massive waves of nausea. You know, I always – Brad DeLong, who I always sort of think of as a doppelganger on the left in terms of how I – you know, which is – Brad and I probably agree on more than we disagree, but he's on one side of the political fence and I'm on the other. He wrote a great post basically despairing about the fact that, you know, the technocratic center has disappeared. And I have to say I tend to agree with him at this point. Now, this is a short-term phenomenon. I think to some extent – The sort of big bet that everyone is making is to what extent does someone like Barack Obama get credit a year from now for not just implementing, you know, relatively ambitious policy schemes, but it, doing so with a process that indicates that he at least is taking bipartisanship seriously. That even if he winds up not, you know, getting a lot of Republican support, I think by and large, you know, an honest political broker would acknowledge that at least that Obama seems to be trying to make the sincere effort to get that support. The question then becomes, a year from now, is Obama unpopular or popular? If he's unpopular, then I really do weep for the future of the country because it's going to start to look more and more and more like a European parliamentary system, which is fine, except we don't actually have a parliamentary system of government, and I think the political culture will clash with American political institutions. If, on the other hand, Obama actually comes off, you know, comes through this and seems more popular as a result. In other words, he gets credit for these kinds of strategies. Well, then you might actually see some political learning take place. You might see the pendulum swift back, you know, shift back from the belief that sort of Gingrich-style political tactics pay off to the notion that you actually do have to, you know, that statesmanship pays off is one way of putting it, which is that, you know, the content of the policies matters, but the process matters as well. And if that's the case, then who knows? You know, I mean, you can argue that up until this last election, the sort of rhetorical aspects of politics have been going downhill for quite some time, and then they've taken a bump up. Maybe the quality of the politics can improve as well. This might be me at my most Pollyanna-ish, though, I will acknowledge.
Yeah, I think that I have a broadly similar view, but I think that actually in some ways it's more optimistic, in some ways it's more pessimistic.
Yeah.
Part of my thought is that I think that basically Bush was seen by the time he left office as basically dishonest, as having sold the public a bill of goods and not having been sincere about the kind of trade-offs necessary to implement his policies. And I think that that has happened to this president as well very, very quickly. I think you know, many people I talk to dismiss this as crazy, and maybe they're right, maybe I'm incredibly ingenuous, but I really do think that if President Obama had said, we need to cover everyone, it's going to be expensive, we might be able to yield some savings, but the truth is that everyone is going to have to trade some disposable income for less risk. Everyone's going to have to pay slightly more in taxes so that we can make this happen. Then I think he would have been almost bulletproof. His popularity would have declined, and then you would have had plenty of people attack him for increasing taxes. But I think that every time the CBO issued a report, it would not be undercutting him, but rather would be reinforcing that kind of a message.
Right.
And I think that it's so baked in the cake, this kind of extreme defensiveness, the sense the public is going to abandon you. And also, I think that, you know, Democrats justify this to themselves, this kind of shortcut to themselves by saying, well, the Republicans are insane, and they're dangerous, and they can't be trusted, so we can actually engage in this kind of truth-telling. We'll be savage. They kind of have this, you know, kind of deep fear of a Republican boogeyman that allows them to do things that are frankly politically expedient.
Yeah.
And I think that on the Republican side, I mean, I, you know, definitely am right of center. I'm incredibly concerned about a long-term debt crisis. I really do think it. But I also think that, you know, we have to acknowledge that there is a revenue shortfall and that we need to do something about that as well. So I think that I just kind of really hope that you start seeing political figures who are willing to be honest with the American public about the kind of trade-offs necessary, because even if we were to pursue a kind of austerity path, we would need to see some kind of tax hike. Even if your goal were to shrink government, I think that you'd need some kind of tax hike. So I think that that's, you know, kind of the source of my, I wouldn't say despair, but frustration at the moment. But it's funny because, you know, you don't know, like, actually who should I be pulling for in this debate right now. I basically think that these reform proposals are being sold pretty misleadingly. But, you know, there's not that much to be done about it.
Go ahead.
Well, I actually, my computer is about to conk out, I think. But,
oh, okay.
But please, if you have a kind of last remark.
No, this was a fun conversation. I appreciate the debate.
Thanks so much. I really, really enjoyed chatting with you, and I hope that kind of the audience learned something from your collected wisdom. And with that, I'll say goodbye.